Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone. And this is Carl from Deviant Legion and the ISF podcast. Glad you could join us today. And today we welcome back a couple of people that have been on before, actually together. So for today, my co-host, I'm very welcome to welcome back and glad to have back Sam Lesson. Sam, say hello.
Hello.
Greetings. And today we are very, very happy to welcome back to the podcast just one of the most iconoclastic directors of odd films I have ever talked to, though we have not met in person. And that would be the inimitable Trent Harris. Trent, thanks for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Boy, I hope I can live up to that intro. That was incredible. I don't even know what inevitable means.
Hey, listen, it's radio. I've been doing this for years. We're masters of bullshit. What can I say?
I know I can't spell it, that's for sure.
So Trent, now those of you that don't know the name, I think you would be very familiar with a specific film that Trent did, or actually two. We're going to be talking about one in particular because his new film, which is called Echo People, is basically a sequel or spiritual sequel to a previous film he did called Reuben and Ed. So, Trent, take it away. Tell us about Echo People connection with Reuben.
I actually like to call it a spinoff rather than a sequel because it's I don't have the sequel rights, oddly enough. Sony owns the sequel rights, so I call it a spinoff, and then I'm fine. But, it's a spinoff of Reuben and Ed, I made that. I think that came out in 1991. And in that movie, there's a lot of references to these people called Echo People. So I just sat down here about a couple of years ago and decided, well, who are these Echo People, and what does that mean? And I decided to make a new movie about Echo People. And it's kind of an echo of Reuben and Ed in some ways. You know, many of the same themes go through it, I guess, would be a good way to describe it.
Yeah. And this has been in gestation for quite a while, has it not?
Well, it's been, yeah, I mean, I was, you know, it's, I don't have a lot of money to make a movie, so often I'll break them into thirds, and then I'll shoot a third, then shoot a third, then shoot a third. That's an inexpensive and quite efficient way to make a movie. So I had a couple of them done, and then I was shooting them kind of episodically, and then COVID hit, of course, and that shut me down for a year. And then I got hit with a crazy weather situation that shut me down for another, you know, 6 months. And so it's taken, you know, from the time I very first started it, it's probably been 3 years ago at least, to getting it finished. Okay. I just premiered it at the smallest film festival in the entire world. It's called the Bicknell International Film Festival. It's in a tiny, tiny desert town in Bicknell, Utah. It's really fun. We have a parade before the film festival, and they only show two movies, and it's in a tiny little theater. I think it's one of the last theaters in America in a town that small that actually still plays movies.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Oh, good, good. So I would hope that your movie won the award for best film.
Well, since they only played two films, Reuben and Ed and Echo People, I think I did win.
There you go. So Sam, why don't you give us a little information about how you and Trent hooked up? And I know you've got a copy of Echo People, and so tell us what you thought of.
Well, Trent reached out to me a few years ago after I ordered Delightful Water Universe from his website. It was, you know, I wanted to start seeing his movies, and that one is the one that catches people's eye. And he invited me to, you know, be friends on Facebook and to his Facebook group, the Ruben and Ed Film People. And he's just a great creator of content.
I certainly make a lot of it.
Well, content both of films and online output. A very enjoyable person to follow. And I was really excited. Yeah?
I was
excited.
Go ahead.
To see the third part of Echo People, because like you said, there was such a big pause in between. And I
yeah,
did,
you saw part one and part two, didn't you? And then
I saw part
yeah,
one and part two as you released them on YouTube a year or two ago.
Yeah.
And they were hysterical. You know, Echo People features Steph Russell, who is my favorite Trent Harris person. And I think his too.
Mine too.
And she's just hilarious. And the film is very dialogue-based, and she's incredibly, incredibly funny with her exasperated co-star. And I guess it follows these two characters who sort of meet by chance, and the one is very mystified by the other. A question that I had for Trent that has just turned into a comment, I guess, because our podcast got delayed several times, I was curious, you know, with that huge space in between Chapter 2 and Chapter 3, if the characters were going to have that kind of Season 2 look where their hair is all wrong and they've gained weight or lost weight. And I have to say it was seamless.
Yeah.
Absolutely hysterical.
They look like that every day.
You can't even tell. You can't tell that there was a couple years in between Chapter 2 and Chapter 3. I thought it was just great, just extremely funny and clever and a joy to watch.
I think Stephanie is ageless. I mean, she was also the star of Plan 10 from Outer Space that I made in, what was that, 1995, I think?
Five, I believe, yeah.
Yeah, 95.
That's
I think
my
it was
favorite
95.
Of yours.
Yeah, and she's the star of that. She's also in the Life of Water universe, and she's in another one I made called Welcome to the Rubber Room. She's just so fun to work with and such a great person. And she's so fun to look at and listen to on screen. She's kind of a screen eater. When she's on screen, you can't look at anything else but her.
Absolutely.
But Pat does a pretty damn good job, too. The gutter guy. Pat's wonderful. You know, the guy that plays opposite her. Basically, there's only three people in Echo People. The cast is three people, and one of them is only in it for a very short time, so it's almost all just two people. And so it's Stephanie and then Pat... Pat Collins, and Pat has been in every feature movie I've made except for one. He was in Reuben and Ed, if you recognize him. Do you remember? He's the lackey in Reuben and Ed, Mr. Busta's lackey.
Oh, yeah.
And then he's in, yeah, he's been in every movie I've made except Luna Mesa.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that brings up a situation, you know, doing smaller films and micro-budget films, you know, it's a sense of getting people around you that have the same vision and that. So tell us a little bit about you know, the people you work with and technically, you know, your cinematographers and that's how did you all start to work together, and particularly in Utah, which is not exactly the most prevalent area that I think of to make films. So very interesting.
Well, there's not a lot. There's not a lot of filmmakers here. There's a few, but not a lot. The fellow that shot, you know, I build a family kind of. It's kind of like a family to me of people that I know and I feel like they're my family. The guy that actually shot Reuben and Ed, Echo People, used to shoot documentaries for me in the mid-70s, 1970s. So I've known him forever. And he's extremely, he's a great DP. He's very good. He knows everything. And he had one assistant who was equally as talented. And so it was basically just three or four people. We made the whole movie. So, you know, Stephanie and Pat have been around forever. And Ken Fall, who shot the movie, like I said, I've been known him for, gosh, like 40 years at least. So you come back to the same people. We are all on the same page. They can read my mind pretty quickly. And I, you know, it's not hard to make a film with these people. I don't have to do a lot of takes or anything. They know what they're doing before we ever get there. They know their characters and they know the sensibility that I have. And it's just quite an enjoyable experience. In fact, it's the most damn fun I ever have in my whole life is making movies.
You know, that's one of the things that as we go through this series with ISF and talking to people, like on Tuesday, we had Mark Pirro, and he's got a new film out also. But we talked to these people, and it is a sense of family. It is that you gather the people around you that have the same vision, and you work together and you come up with a finished product.
Did you see Alejandro Jodorowsky's Dune? And he talks about gathering his warriors together.
That's
and it's
goodness.
Right.
I always love that kind of analogy. You gather your warriors together and then you go to battle and make the film.
Yeah. And I mean, we even do that on the podcast here. We have people that have joined us and we're working toward a more, you know, getting more people together and more coverage and so on and so forth. And that does bring something up. You know, now you certainly have your own website, and we certainly want to hear about that. But what do you do in terms of distribution and post-production?
Well, post-production, I do it all myself. I mean, you don't need much, a computer, and if you're clever enough, you can do the post-production. In terms of distribution, it's just so hard. I mean, I have certain theaters that will run my movies that are around the country, actually in different countries, too. There's one in Amsterdam. There's one in Mexico City. There's a couple in Brooklyn, I think, that'll do it. There's a, you know, I have a screening coming up in Los Angeles at the Fairfax. So there's a few theaters out there that will run my movies, you know, not any lengthy run, but they'll get them out and show them. And then I don't stream anything because I sell DVDs of the films and Blu-rays, and I think that's a better way to see a movie and it's a better way to distribute a movie, I think, than streaming. I mean, I could put it on Netflix or something, but it wouldn't work. I mean, you know, unless you've got $1 zillion in publicity, nobody's going to find it. So,
right.
You know, distribution is really hard. I don't know how to do it, and I don't know anybody that does, quite frankly, except for, I mean, one of the reasons I get stuff out is just because I've been around for so damn long, too. You know, I've been doing this, well, easily since the 90s. I've been making movies since the 70s, but since the web came out in the 90s, and, you know, I've got another, what have I got? I got something coming up in Boulder, Colorado in a couple of weeks. And so, I, you know, it's real hit and miss and real small. Let's put it that way. You know, if I was in this for the money, I don't have a good business plan. Let's put it that way.
But you do it for the love of it, though. I can tell that just by talking to you, Trent.
Yeah.
I mean, this is all about love and about doing it and getting your vision out there and you know, having a small but very, very vibrant cult following. And
yeah.
Sam, I would think
when
probably
that
one
is
the,
so rewarding. It's so rewarding to know that there's a group of people out there that enjoy these films as much as I do. You know, it's a small group, but I just love them all for doing it. It's a lot of fun.
And that's one of the things that we try to make, you know, people at ISF, we've got to have a lot of beginning filmmakers and that sort of thing. And they all ask about, you know, why, you know, I want to do this, but I need this, and I and so many people to say, go ahead and do it. Just do it. You know.
Yeah.
Seriously.
That's true. That's true. Somebody asked Stanley Kubrick, how do you become a director? And he said, well, you start directing movies. And it was, and he wasn't being flip. He was being correct. You know, you just start doing it.
And somebody will notice at one point or another, maybe, or maybe not, but you still do it anyway because it's what you want to do. You know, absolutely. It took me a long time to figure that one out for me. So, hey. Now, if we can get people to understand that and filmmakers just to go out and do it and have the support and certainly, you know, being connected with Incredibly Strange Films, which is a large Facebook group of now over 400,000 members.
Wow.
You know, yeah, we got to do more for you on that. So, you know, I'll get in touch with you. And we'll try to push it even more.
Are you what's your connection with that website? I didn't realize that you were part of that.
Well, basically, I was an admin for quite a while there. Started with David Whittington around 25 or 30,000 and between just happenstance and doing a little bit of work, that group has grown. And what has happened now, they have like 12 admins, I mean 12 mods, and I'm still an admin, but I branched off a couple years ago with Theater and Legion, and so I'm connected with them in those terms. But I don't do much as far as the...
It sure is a fun website to look at. I mean, page to look at. It's a fun Facebook page.
Well, you know what? That's the whole thing. That one of the wonderful things about what you do, and what we try to do at ISF, and what we also try to do at DLN, Deviant Legion, is that we want to spotlight the people who are sort of under the radar. But do some significant work and do stuff that's unique. And let me tell you something, Trent. There ain't anybody out there like you. I mean,
there are other people with a sense of humor,
you know, like you are, but it's not the same sense of humor. And you know, that's what we try to do. Very, very much so.
Well, I sure appreciate it.
Well, as I said, we'd like to do more at one point or another. I'm starting to focus now on really getting the filmmakers involved there, the first-time filmmakers, finding some sort of distribution for them and so on and so forth. So over the past couple months, we're going to be making some major, major changes and some major announcements here by the end of the year. So there's a lot going in there. But I actually want to get back to the film. So Sam, what do you have any other questions for Trent or thoughts on the film? What I know you watched it. So
I
what
sure
did you think?
Well, like I said, I loved it and I knew I would. I had seen 2/3 of it already and of course, I watched it from the beginning. I am more an appreciator of film. I'm not a huge talker. It didn't leave me with any questions. It left me happy and satisfied.
Well, that's good.
I really don't know what to say. I mean, I learned so much a year ago. When we did this with Trent, I mean, he told us so many stories and explained so much stuff, and I felt really, really lucky to be part of that. And, yeah, I'm not exactly sure what to say other than if people want to see some actual Incredibly Strange Films, they should start with Trent. They should go to echocave.net and buy his DVDs and support a true independent filmmaker who's doing stuff that no one's ever done.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
I had one good thing to tell you about Echo People. If you remember, there's a scene kind of in the middle of the movie where our main character's frog has died, and she's had the frog cremated, and the other character spills the ashes. You know what I'm talking about?
I do.
Yeah. Well, those ashes, and it really, of course, upsets her. Well, those ashes are actually a filmmaker friend of mine, and one of my best friends that I ever had, his name was Larry Roberts, and he died back in 1988, and we had him cremated, and I carried his ashes around in the glove box of my car since 1988, and because
wow.
I didn't know what to do with them. You know, I didn't want to just, I didn't know where to put them or how to put them. But then it came to me when I was making this film that this would be the perfect way to use Larry's ashes. So when the character spills the frog ashes, it's actually Larry Roberts, my friend. It's his ashes. So we put him in the credits even.
I can feel my hair growing right now. Wow. I can't wait to tell my two friends who I watched it with. Wow. That's amazing. What an honor.
He was a great filmmaker, and it was too bad he died so young. He was a good friend and a great filmmaker. But, yeah, what a good way for him to end, I thought. Put him in the movie at the very end. He even put his ashes in.
That's incredible.
I would say that's probably the first time that ever happened. I've never experienced that one before.
Oops, I lost you there. What'd you say?
I said, I don't think that's ever been done before. Actually,
yeah,
having somebody's ashes. Yeah.
For a second, it sounded like you were underwater, Carl.
That's what I thought.
So I have a question. If you were to describe your films as far as, you know, point of view, or, you know, what are the overlying, I don't want to get too film school, but overlying themes or that in your films?
Well, I think if you look at just about all my films, they're all about heroic misfits. You know, people that are really misfits in society, but they're heroic in one way or another. I'm just drawn to that kind of a character. You know, I think that's really it in a nutshell. I mean, I was trying to think, Reuben and Ed, both of those guys are heroic misfits. Definitely Echo People. Definitely Rubber Room. Definitely, you know, most of my movies are about people who are outside of society, people that most people wouldn't be friends with, quite frankly, and those are the people I love the most, usually.
Well, I think you basically have described everyone at ISF, including me. So there you
well,
go.
Well, I figure.
So let me ask you this. What do you have? Do you have anything planned afterwards, after this and after your showing?
Oh, yeah. I started a movie, 3 days after I was finished with Echo People. I started another one. It's pretty good. It's called Revenge of the Virgins. And it's a found footage film. So I've got tons and tons and tons of old found footage from many, many different movies. And I've been, you know, putting it into a kind of a collage story. It's really fun. I got about 10 minutes of it done, and it works really well. So I'm going to fiddle with that for a while. I don't really have the energy or the money to go out and pull together a crew and another script right now. So I'm... you know, I'm working on that. I was named the filmmaker in residence, actually, at the University of Utah in their department. So I'm teaching a class in directing up there, which is a lot of fun. It's a very small class and very interesting students. I like teaching directing. I taught writing for a while, but directing's a lot more fun, I think.
Oh, that's very cool. I'm glad that's happening for you. You know,
yeah.
So do you find that your students know who you are and know your work, or you have
no,
to,
I
like,
mean, a couple of them will, but they're all tied into streaming. That's where they're getting all of their, not all of their movies, but most of their movies are getting through streaming.
Shame.
So, you know, my feature films, I'd made four features before these kids were even born. So it's hard for them to, you know, they wouldn't know those films because they're not streamed. But, you know, once they figure out, oh, Reuben and Ed, oh, Beaver Trilogy, oh, and then they start to catch on a bit. And then I show them some of my other stuff. Actually, speaking of Heroic Misfits, Beaver Trilogy is really that in a nutshell, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that? Because I would think some of the people who didn't hear the last podcast might not know exactly how that came about. And it's quite an interesting story.
Yeah, it was. I started off as a documentary. I made a short documentary about a young man from Beaver, Utah, who liked to dress up like Olivia Newton-John. And he ended up shooting himself, unfortunately, right after I'd filmed him. And it kind of rattled my cage, and I sat back and tried to figure out why, and I ended up writing a little script about it, and I got Sean Penn to play the part. So I kind of did a part two of the Beaver Trilogy, which is almost exactly the same story as the documentary, only starring Sean Penn, and it didn't seem to quite work the way I wanted it to, so I did it a third time, changed the script a bit, and put in Crispin Glover as the Beaver kid. Then I sat back and hooked all three of them together, and when all three of them got hooked together, it was like, wow, this is really a different animal. You know, I hadn't planned on, when I was making it, I hadn't really thought of it as a, you know, putting them all together in one piece like that. But once I did, it was like, good Lord, that is a completely different thing. I've never seen anything like it, and it works in a very interesting way.
Well, you know, part of that, I would think, is that, you know, it might be happenstance, but you're the one that thought about putting them together.
Yeah.
And it's about, you know, your artistic sense, or however you want to say it.
You know what it was, is I needed money at the time, and I thought, well, I'll have a screening at the Utah Film and Video Center, and I thought, well, what have I got? I thought, well, I'll hook these three together. So that was the real impetus, and then it was like, oh, my God, what is this creature I've created? But, yeah.
Well, that's wonderful stuff. Sam, I know you have some thoughts on the Beaver Trilogy, because we talked about it previously.
I can only echo what Trent said. It is an extremely unique creature. People need to see it to comprehend it. And it's important to point out that Sean Penn had was in basically nothing at that point, too.
Right, that's for sure.
Also pretty interesting in the third one, the Orkley kid. You've got Courtney Gaines.
Uh-huh.
You have the girl who was in she was in Valley
Elizabeth
Girl.
Bailey?
And, yes, Bailey, yes.
Yeah.
I think another – so I mean, I like everything that you did. I like all of your films very, very much. One in particular that I think is incredibly important that people should see, and you could maybe talk about a little bit, is your documentary, The Cement Ball.
Oh, you saw
that one
too.
Tell people what you did there. Because I think that would just fascinate any listener.
Well, I spent a good chunk of 5 years in Cambodia with a Khmer Rouge soldier. Khmer Rouge, that's the killing fields, to make a long story short. If you've seen The Killing Fields, you'll understand what the Khmer Rouge is. Anyway, his name was Aki Ra, and Aki was conscripted into the Khmer Rouge when he was 8 years old. They killed his parents, and then they made him a child soldier, and he laid landmines and fought battles and all that stuff. And after the war, he decided he was going to go out and clear landmines. He wanted to help his country. So he'd go out and do it by himself. He had a stick and a pocket knife. When I met him first, he had already cleared about 10,000 mines just by himself. So I started following him around for a long time and filming various things and clearing landmines with him. I mean, we'd go out in the afternoon, we'd get 40 landmines in an area not big, much bigger than two cars. I mean, there's millions of them in Cambodia.
Yeah.
But it's sort of a story about redemption. I mean, he'd done all these terrible things when he was a kid, and he's gone out and become, talk about a hero, talk about a misfit heroic hero.
Absolutely.
He's a key raw, yeah.
There are moments in that documentary that are as intense as anything Werner Herzog has done. There really are.
No, that stuff with the landmine, clearing the landmine and banging on it, that is pretty
terrifying and real.
You know, I look back at that. I mean, they were digging these landmines up out of the dirt, and they're, you know, taking them apart right while I'm standing there. And at the time, I wasn't afraid, and it was because I was looking through the camera, and it didn't, you know, when I'm looking through the camera, it seems like it's a movie. But I came back and watched it, and Then I got scared. I said, what in the hell was I thinking? What was I doing? You know, we're standing right in the middle of a minefield. It was pretty crazy.
That intrigues me, that whole thing. That's really something.
I make these goofy comedies, but I did quite a few things in covering genocides, oddly enough. I'd make documentaries to pay the bills and stuff like that, and I did documentaries in Rwanda, in Sierra Leone, in South Africa a long time ago, in Burma most recently with that mess. Cambodia.
So how did you get the jobs as far as doing the documentaries? How did that all come about?
Well, you know, I started doing documentaries. Well, as soon as I got out of school, I started making documentaries for a television station. And I've done it throughout my whole life. I mean, I love making documentaries. And I finally got hooked up with a WNET in New York, a show that they were doing, and I'd pitch them stories, and they'd send me off to these places, partly because nobody else wanted to go to them, and I really wanted to go to them, and I knew how to handle my way through. You know, I knew how to travel in these areas and get in and out and get a good story. So, you know, I did quite a few. I think I was trying to figure out how many films I'd actually made. I made like 140, 150 films, if you add them all up. If you add the documentaries and the shorts and the experimental films and the features, I just make films all the time.
The one projected on a basketball?
Yeah, that's true. I wish I had that one still. I'm so sad I lost that.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah, it's interesting because if you take a look at your IMDb, it doesn't really show a lot of that work.
No, I mean, I don't even pay any attention to that IMDb. I guess I should get on there and do something, but I don't know. I'm too busy.
So. Tell us a little bit about, give us a little background on EchoNet and what's on it and what people can see, and give us a little bit of promotion for yourself.
Sure. Okay. I have a website called echocave.net. And, or if you just do a Google search for Trent Harris, films, you can find it that way too. But, yeah, I mean, I can sell my DVDs on there, but I also have books that I've written and a lot of my artwork that you can look at. And I've got something on there called Coconut Monkey TV, which has about I don't know, probably 30 or 40 short films that I've made that you can just, those are streamed. So you can go on Coconut Monkey TV and look at these goofy short things that I made. There's some neat pieces on there, actually, on that Coconut Monkey TV. I did a documentary on Timothy Leary, another one on Allen Ginsberg, put little clips like that kind of stuff in. So it's sort of a, and then I put up my DVDs for sale there. People seem to think that DVDs are dead, but they're really not. There are people out there that collect these things. So, I mean, I don't sell a lot of them, but I sell enough of them to keep doing it.
You got some memorabilia
on
there,
t-shirts. Oh, absolutely.
What's that?
And that's one thing. Go ahead, Sam. I'm sorry.
That's all. Just there's another tab for where some of, I know you've sold a few pieces from your films. And,
the collector's corner.
Yeah.
Yeah, most of that stuff I've sold. I've got to get in there and update that. I sold like the clapboard for Reuben and Ed. I sold the shoe from Reuben and Ed. I sold the cat even from Reuben and Ed, the stuffed cat. And that's how I financed the rubber room, I think, is that through that. There's little goofy things on there that I sold, animation cells from Plan 10 from Outer Space. But I've got a real bargain going on. If people buy Echo People, they get an absolutely free rubber ant included in the purchase.
Which ties into the film.
Yeah, everybody's like going, well, rubber ant, what's he talking about? But if you've seen the movie, you know what do they say is you never know when you're going to need a rubber ant.
There's all sorts of echoes. Like you said, I mean, we see the shoes come back, we see the hubcap come back. The frog is really an echo of the cat, I think.
Yeah. I know, the frog's great, isn't it? That was my frog. I'm so sad that frog did die. I had a pet frog named El Croco, and I thought he was a pretty good actor. I mean, he does some pretty good things in that movie. But He went on to Frog Heaven here a couple of months ago. It was really
awesome.
I know.
Well, you know, that's unfortunate, but that does happen
to everything.
Know, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's funny you talk about the rubber ant. I don't know if you know a guy by the name of David Rock Nelson, but he does some micro-budget stuff. And I was at Monster Mash Bash about 4 or 5 years ago, and he was filming at Monster Bash, and all of a sudden he had this monster ant that was attacking me.
No, I don't think I know he's still good. I
might just have to buy Echo People just for the for the rubber ant, without a doubt.
I know.
You should anyway.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is true. Unfortunately, I don't have a player right now. I do my stuff through streaming, but I can change that. That isn't a problem.
Oh, you got to get a DVD player. But you got to get a Blu-ray player. Some of the extras on Blu-rays now are just incredible. You know,
absolutely.
Wonderful documentaries
absolutely.
And add-ons.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Just give us a little bit of background on all the films, and I think we'll probably start wrapping this up at this point.
I don't know how to give you a background on all of the films. That's for sure.
Just think a couple that you think people should watch. Maybe.
Well, I Plan 10 from Outer Space is still hanging in there. I mean, that thing premiered at Sundance in 1995, and I'm still selling those things. It's a wonderful science fiction movie based on Mormon doctrine, actual Mormon doctrine. Karen Black, the stars in it, along with Stephanie.
That reminds me. Stephen Eckleberry says hello.
What's that?
Stephen Eckleberry says hello to you. He wanted to make sure that I say hello.
Really? Where did you see him?
Well, he was on the podcast a while back.
Oh,
because
really?
Karen's Yeah, Karen just they just put out the album of her demos in the 70s. And I know Stephen through Dan Kramer,
right.
Who is a filmmaker out in San Francisco. And so I had Stephen on about a month or so ago, and to promote the album, and it came to talk to you because she was in a couple of your films, he said
what a delightful person she was.
Oh, so tell us a little bit about you know working with Karen maybe and of course. Everybody at ISF is going to want to know about working with Crispin. I've been trying to get Bruce on.
Opposite. Karen was, Karen was just great. She called me up and she said, "Trent, I heard this is on Plan 10. She said, "I heard you're making a movie." I said, "Yeah, Karen, but you got to understand, I don't have any money at all." And she said, "I don't care. I'll be up there on Friday. Make sure there's a part for me." And so she came up and did Nihor and Plan 10 from Outer Space. She's just wonderful. She's just a lot of fun. And the thing I loved about her the most is she likes to work. It's all about work. I mean, you've seen how many movies she's been in. It must be hundreds. And everything from Academy Award movies to the, lowest budget kind of horror sleaze movies. She just would do anything. She just loved to act, and she was so good at it and so generous. She's a wonderful person. I hope Steve's doing okay.
Yeah, he seemed to be. He's certainly, pushing as much with Karen's work. I'll tell you a story that Dan Kramer told me.
Name is so familiar.
His newest film just came out. From Kino Lorber, or not his newest film, but the previous one he premiered, which is called Overwhelm the Sky. But he was at Karen's memorial service, and he tells a story of Elliot Gould coming up and talking about Karen, and they were in a film called Capricorn One. And so he goes to pick her up, and they're going to film a scene where she picks him up at his apartment. But there's a previous phone call that was never filmed. So as they're driving to location, she says, "Well, let's work on the phone call so we can know what we're doing when I pick you up." And he says, "Well, we don't need to do that." And they go off for a while. And then suddenly she just turns to him and says, "Ring, ring, 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 ring." And he just looks and he says, "There was no chance I was going to get out of that. So I had to answer the fucking phone."
Yep, that's Karen.
It's amazing.
So tell us a little bit about working with Crispin. This ought to be interesting.
Well, I mean, it's okay. I wouldn't do it again. That's to make a long story short. I don't want to. Crispin is a really, really good actor, and he brings things to characters that are unique and wonderful and fascinating to watch. I mean, he was in two of my films, and he did a great job in both of them. But I don't know. We just kind of went our different ways after Ruben and Ed. It was sort of like we both just sort of had enough, I think. So we just waved goodbye.
That'll happen.
It was just like the Beatles breaking up.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I did one of those with my former partner. So, yeah, I understand that completely. But, you take a look at his work, though, and his work in Moving in Ed is just stellar. It really is. And for everyone.
He did a great job.
No question. And for everyone, and I'll be honest, Ruben and Ed is the movie that I know you from and everything. I mean, that's your most accessible film. In terms of watching it and and that sort of thing. But that film is just so unique and so wonderful.
Well, I just think he did just even a better job in the Beaver trilogy. I mean, I thought that one was, he just hit that right on the head. He did such a good job in that movie. I read all kinds of people for that part. And, you know, it's the part of a young man from Beaver, Utah, who likes to dress up like Olivia Newton-John. And if it's not done right, it is really ludicrous. And I read, I must have read 30 people for that part. And Crispin did it. He pulled it off, and it worked just wonderfully.
Did anyone who read for that become well-known? Any names?
Well, I think, Nick Cage would be one. Anthony Edwards was another. I think Eric Stoltz was another.
Wow.
There was a whole bunch of young, you know, that whole little crowd there in the 80s. There was that bunch and Sean and, you know, there was kind of these, what they call them, the Brat Pack or whatever it was. I mean, I didn't read Emilio Estevez, but he was part of that that group. But yeah, so they were all doing acting classes, I think, at the same place, which was this woman named Peggy Fury, and I think, you know, that's how I think they got to know each other, and then they were all kind of friends or at least acquaintances. But yeah, it was an exciting time, right? The early '80s in Los Angeles was there's a lot going on. It's not quite the same now, I don't think, but.
Well, you made. How did you end up in Utah? You know,
I grew up in Idaho, a small town in Idaho. My mother was a newspaper reporter, and we moved from town to town to town, and then finally she got a job in Salt Lake City, working for the city, and so we moved here when I was about, I don't know, probably about 13 or something like that. So I, you know, lived here and went to school and then moved away to Los Angeles. I lived there for about 14 years or something, but I just didn't like it there. It just was not my idea of how to spend a life.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't like the industry, didn't like the crowd, didn't like, you know, didn't like the climate, didn't like the confusion. But there was something really wonderful about being in Los Angeles, and it was the people that you would meet that were striving to be excellent. That's something that you don't find very often. You really don't find it here much in Utah, but they, you know, people like Sean Penn and Crispin and Cage and David Lynch and all of these people who are just going for the best possible game, and you get around those people and it's exciting. You know, it
Absolutely.
Really is. Yeah.
You know, I mean, I was here in the city, New York City, in the 80s, and I always say the two best things that ever happened to me was moving to the city and then moving out of the city. and it's very much the same way. The one thing is, if you get on that type of circle and that sort of thing, and you're always hustling and that sort of thing, that can take a lot out of you.
Oh, sure.
And so it just wasn't working for me. And so I moved back and took care of my parents' music store for a number of years. So, you know, and a small town in northwestern Pennsylvania. So I absolutely understand what you're saying, without a doubt.
Yeah.
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
So at this point,
sometimes I miss it.
Oh, go ahead.
But you. Oops, sorry. Go ahead.
No. You go ahead, Trent.
I think Sam was going to say something.
I didn't say anything.
Yeah.
Well, why not?
I'm just enjoying being a fly on the wall. or a rubber ant on the wall.
Of the radio.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I miss that kind of buzz. But there are some people here there's a small group here that's quite extraordinary. Some of them, a guy named Alex Caldiero, another one named Scott Carrier and Ken Sanders. There's a small group of people here who are really extraordinary in what they do. And And of course, they're all my best friends, so that helps. It's just not the big group. And the stakes are different. The stakes are different. These people aren't going for fame and fortune. They're just going for work, you know, to do really great things, really great work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think again, it's a sense of what we were talking about previously in terms of, you know, developing your close contacts and your family that work with you and friends and so on and so forth. And I think that's absolutely really important. So right now I thought what we would do is what we like to call housekeeping, which sort of gives you an idea of what's coming up on Deviant Legion. So tomorrow, Adam Ferenz is going to be hosting the Cathode Ray Mission. They're going to be doing a show on the West Wing. And on Saturday, Doc and my co-host Rachel and I will be doing a special commentary watch of the Sonny Chiba film in honor of his recent passing. We'll be doing a commentary watch on The Bodyguard. Next week, we have, it's not set in stone, but it will be probably be by the end of the day. We have some first-time filmmakers that we're going to be featuring for the next couple of weeks on the ISF podcast, and they're members of Incredibly Strange Films, and we're going to be doing more and more of that. I would also say anyone from ISF who has been involved in either feature films or short films, we just put an announcement up there to contact me directly, and we'll get you on the podcast, and we'll help promote you. Again, my name is Carl Kafer. I also want to give a shout-out to a friend of the podcast who's a former podcaster for us. His name is Limes Marshall, and he's out of Toronto. And he has a YouTube distribution channel called Ice Creams, and he focuses on basically sci-fi and horror short films, things like that. He just had a major setback in that somebody hacked and deleted his Instagram following. Yeah, it's unfortunate, and that happened yesterday. So whoever did that, shall I just put your earphones in? Whoever did that, fuck you, okay? Seriously.
But, my hack's on that person.
Follow him on YouTube. That he has some great short films and great, and he's also really good at his rants are really funny. So yeah, follow Lines. And that's what we got. So one more chance, Trent, give us a little bit of promotion and talk about your website and give us all the info.
Well, the greatest people in the world go to this website. It's called echocave.net. It's the most amazing films that have ever been made by anybody ever. And they're not very much money. Plus, you can look at my artwork, my books, and my TV station called Coconut Monkey TV. But visit it. It's really cool. It'll give you an idea of how many, you know, goofball movies I've made over the years. Echocave.net.
And I gotta say the Monkey TV is just you just start watching it, you cannot stop. Seriously.
Coconut Monkey TV.
Yeah. Okay, and Sam,
I'm looking at my Coconut Monkey right now. I've actually got one.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. They're hard to find anymore.
You know, it's funny. Order Echo people, get the rubber band. I have I don't know if you know a couple people, if you know Mark Pirro or not, but Mark had a movie called Gone Complex, and I just ordered this thing that he made, toy called the Submissive Jesus, Also, there's a guy by the name of Joe Badon who did a film called Sister Tempest, and I got the toy astronaut. So, yeah, I love those things.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you need a rubber ant for your collection.
We'll be talking. We'll be talking, Mr. Trent. No question about that, my friend. All right, Sam.
Well, thanks for having me on, you guys. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Sam, do you want to say anything else before we all head off into the wild blue?
I just want to say thank you to you, Carl, for having me on again. And, Trent, it's always an honor and a privilege. Thank you.
Okay.
Absolutely.
All right, I'll see you guys later. Rock on, Pioneers.
All right, absolutely. Okay, folks, thank you very, very much for listening. We will be back on Saturday with the commentary watch, and on Tuesday I'll be announcing that very shortly. So thank you very much. Sam, again, my pleasure to have you on. You're welcome anytime, my friend. All right, and good night, or good afternoon, or whatever it is. Good afternoon.